See, I had originally in Chicago, when I was there in the early 1950s, got to know Chandra Sekhar very well, and Chandra used to take me down every week to the Fermi Institute, or what was then the Institute, I've forgotten what it was called, but right. Fermi was there, and Chandra was working with Fermi on cosmic ray acceleration processing. And I used to sit in on these discussions sometimes, mm-hmm. and I got somewhat interested in the cosmic ray problems, and the Fermi mechanism was the popular acceleration mechanism in those days.
Right.
Essentially, you have charged particles colliding with interstellar clouds, and they attempt to reach equilibrium with the clouds, and so they gradually build their energy up. Of course, they never do reach equilibrium. And I suddenly one day had the bright idea, well, if you took a cluster of galaxies and bounced charged particles off galaxies, then you could gain even larger factors ultimately, and if particles were trapped in galaxies, you could get the very highest energy cosmic rays. So
I see.
That's what that paper was about.
Was it? Did it have to do with the association, which was beginning to become clear in the late 50s, between radio sources and clusters of galaxies?
Was no, radio sources weren't. I can't remember. I mean, there were some radio sources and clusters, but what I was in trying to understand that there were some early results which suggested there were very high energy cosmic rays, which could not be confined to the galaxy, which must escape and therefore might very well have come from other galaxies. And there was a fundamental problem, which there still is. How do you make such very high energy particles?
Right.
Now people sometimes appeal to pulsars and other things, but this was one way of doing it. But
right,
it really was not in any, as I remember, in any obvious way related to radio sources, though I haven't read the paper for years.
Well, one thing that motivated you was that was the false 21 centimeter observations, I believe, at that time, indicating that there was gas in clusters. I'm not sure about that. But
well, no, that led to quite a different investigation. The Agassiz station dedicated their 60-foot radio telescope around 56,
I think, yes.
And Dave Heeshan announced, he was a student there at the time, that they had detected 21 centimeter radiation from the Coma cluster,
right,
and the Hercules cluster, and another cluster. I don't remember what the other one was. It could have been the Perseus cluster. Now, I don't think any of these results were correct, but I knew about the Coma cluster, and I knew about the Perseus cluster. I'd never heard of the Hercules cluster. So I went to Bader and asked him about the Hercules cluster, and he brought out this beautiful set of plates of the Hercules cluster, which is a marvelous cluster of galaxies. It's nothing whatever to do with radio astronomy. And Margaret and I started a study of the Hercules cluster,
right,
which was one of the first clusters which was studied by us and shown not to apparently obey the Virial theorem, which is another
right.
major controversy in
right.
astronomy, but it's nothing whatever to do with radio astronomy.
Well, my present work on the Hercules cluster is directly following in that
yeah.
sort of thing, more redshifts.
But that's how it came about, and
right.
the results which led me to look at the thing, I think, turned out to be wrong, but that was beside the point. Really.
Well, now here, you had a paper in APJ in 58, in which my summary says that radio sources and clusters of galaxies may not just be a single abnormal galaxy, but also from intergalactic clouds that have a weak magnetic field.
I don't remember much about that.
That it indicates anyway that you were being influenced by the association of the galaxies and the clusters.
I imagine so, yes.
Yeah. But now, here's another paper at an IU symposium in Stockholm, where you were talking about the magnetic field in general in all kinds of radio sources, all the
yes.
standard ones,
yes.
CAS, TORUS,
yes. yeah. Yeah.
and so forth. So no matter whether it was a supernova remnant or a galaxy or an unidentified source, you were quite content that the synchrotron mechanism looked like the way to go, the only, or at least the
yes,
most plausible
I felt,
way.
I felt that the Crab had settled the issue for galactic sources, and M87 had settled it for extragalactic sources, and I saw no reason to argue in other directions. I was not unhappy that some supernova remnants showed no appreciable optical radiation, and I felt that you could do something about the physics using the synchrotron theory. That's right.
When was it that the problem of all this energy coming from a small location arose? Would you say that was getting into the early 60s?
Well, it wasn't so much the location. I mean, what really happened was that from the beginning, as soon as I'd found these very large energies, I realized that the fundamental problem was, how can this much energy be released in these modes? And the original argument was that in some mysterious way, radio sources or extragalactic radio sources are associated with collisions between galaxies. And that was pushed very hard by Bader Minkowski. Bader, because he felt he could see two galaxies in Cygnus A, and none of us, the rest of us, used to look at his place and say, but come on, Walter, what are you looking at? He said, it has to be, it is. Then there was the result on 1275 where you saw two sets of velocities.
Right.
Which we later did a detailed study on that optically and concluded that it was matter being ejected, as I think Minkowski had argued, though he was very unsure. That was in 65 that we wrote that paper. Later on, various observations have made some people want to go back to the idea that there's two galaxies involved, which I certainly don't believe. But there was this argument about collisions between galaxies.
And Centaurus, of course.
But it became obvious early on that this was not the explanation. You had single galaxies like Centaurus, you had... Well, there was no evidence in many systems for any other galaxy around, and quite a number of the radio sources appeared to be fairly undisturbed ellipticals. And of course you also could do a simple calculation of the frequency with which you would see collisions. And then and that's what Ambatsumian did. Ambatsumian also attacked the collision hypothesis. And then you had the argument that even if you did have collisions, there was no obvious way in which you could get all this energy out, because only the gas would interact, and it was not clear how you would accelerate the particles, it was not clear that you could get the magnetic fields, it was certainly not clear that you could get the double lobes. And so, independent of the structure in the in the radio source, the detailed structure, it was clear it was not collisions. The antimatter argument didn't work. Shklovsky tried infall of matter, that didn't work. There's no obvious reason why that should work. That led me in 1961 to propose a multiple theory of supernovae, chain reactions of supernovae, which I liked and I still like. It's an attractive idea. You pack the stars in the system close enough together so that one explodes and triggers another one, which triggers another one. Though I was told, well, we all really don't believe it works now. It's got this kind of detonation wave hypothesis that's been played with. It in those days was related to classified work, which caused some problems. But at that stage, I became convinced, at least, that it had to come out of a very small volume, and this was independent of any observations, which didn't really bear on that in the scales that I was talking about. And we then went the route. Remember, I got this extensive background in theoretical physics and in nuclear synthesis, so one then went the route that it had to be nuclear energy,
mm-hmm.
or it had to be gravitational energy. And by 1962, I was pushing this multiple supernova theory, and I always remember that in 62, I think it was 62, it was probably the summer of 62. Yes, it was. It was the summer of 62. We were in Cambridge in England. And I was pushing this argument very hard, and we were mostly still doing nuclear synthesis, but Fred and Willie were there in Cambridge, and I remember arguing with them for days and days that it had to be this kind of theory. They, neither of them liked the multiple supernova theory. And I think if you talk to them, you will find that it was through this persistence of mind, but you've got to find some explanation, that they first started thinking about massive objects and gravitational collapse, which led them in 63 to publish a paper in which they argued that that must be the energy source, mm-hmm. in which they argued that they would turn a blind eye, a deaf ear, and a cold shoulder to anybody to any questions about where these things originated, but it was collapse of massive objects. Then in 64, Margaret and I, Willie and Fred, wrote a paper in APJ in which we, for the first time, argued in a more general way that massive objects were responsible for these phenomena and that they could also give rise to black holes. Ultimately, and in fact, there's a section in that paper in which Fred and I discussed, well, it was written by all of us, but I remember Fred and I talked about stars evolving into black holes, and of course we got into terrible trouble because in those days, optical astronomers were not prepared to believe that black holes existed anywhere,
Sure.
And I remember asking Chandra why he thought this was the case, and he said, well, Jeffrey, they simply won't believe in anything they can't see. And that's why they only believe in white dwarfs, and they won't even believe in neutron stars. So it was through that sequence of events that led me, at least, to argue that you could only get this large amount of energy from gravitational sources, which is where I think the problem stands right now.
So the large energy requirements were a real problem long before you had the small volume as an observation.
Well, one knew in a certain sense that if you were going gravitationally, it had to come out of a small volume.
Well, no, but I'm saying even before, in the late 50s, yes. Even before you...
Well, I would say by 1961, when I wrote that multiple supernova paper, it was clear what kinds of conditions were required. And you'll find the scale after... I mean, there were a number of people who wrote on that subject, and there became a flood of people all pushing a few ideas in the early 1960s. And then, of course, the quasi-stellars came along, and the arguments were made based on them. But the energetic problems did not start with the quasi-stellars. They started and remain with the radio galaxies.
Right. Now, you alluded to the double lobes in Cygnus A, and there were a couple others that were discovered by the late 50s, I guess Centaurus primarily. Seems to me like this issue was sort of avoided by everyone as to...
Well, we just used to discuss it. I remember John Bolton arguing that they must be Tor... what's the plural of Taurus? Toroids. Tori, I don't know. Anyway,
Toroids.
And we immediately... yes, that's probably true. And we immediately convinced ourselves, I remember at Caltech in the discussion, that we couldn't do it that way because the relative frequency of different orientations was totally wrong. The double nature was indeed avoided, and continued to be avoided for a very long time. One knew that there had to be an axis in the system which would do it. Early on, one was aware, and I may have said in various publications, that the one obvious way to get a spherically symmetrical explosion to become axisymmetric would be to simply use a rotation axis or something like that. And you have matter in a plane, and the expansion won't go in the plane, but it'll go perpendicular to the plane. But that problem certainly was avoided.
And I guess only with the half-mile observations, I mean, the mile telescope in the late 60s, when you began to get all these doubles, was it taken up again?
I think earlier than that, everybody accepted that the majority of them were double. I mean, three-quarters of them are doubles, have been around for much longer than that.
That's true. Owens Valley stuff in the very early 60s.
It was one of the well-known observational facts, but it wasn't really a point that people thought about. I mean, I don't feel the subject has advanced a great deal in a significant number of years. What's happened is that gravitational energy in some mysterious way is now all associated with black holes, and double radio sources are somehow associated with relativistic beams, but this is because... people like Martin Rees are pushing very hard on an ingenious idea, which I don't think probably is right, but I mean, the problem that we still don't understand is the way in which we get the energy out in the form in which we see it. There's no obvious reason why gravitational energy should be converted to relativistic particles and or magnetic flux at high efficiency, and that still remains the case.
Or why it should be shot out into pairs.
Well, it is shot out, because... Yeah. The source is down here, and you see stuff out here. Well, the other thing is that you've got to feed something out there, and there again, the question is, do you feed matter out and continuously pump things out here, or do you, as Martin Rollo has always described my ideas in more recent years, do you eject power stations?
Right. Now, more generally, if you can think about the influence... Now, my study is ending in the early 60s. So up to that point, if you could... What would be your comments on the influence of radio astronomy on the course of astronomy from your vantage point?
Well, I think that the greatest influence was associated with, prior to these developments, everybody assumed that galaxies were very stable, long-lived, slowly radiating objects, and violent events in galaxies had never been conceived of, at least for me, I think that what radio astronomy did above all in the extragalactic field was demonstrate that violent events in galaxies are fairly commonplace. So the paper that we wrote in 63 with Alan Sandage, Margaret and I, in Reviews of Modern Physics, where we put together all the observations bearing on violent events and made for the first time, I think, a strong case that there were explosive phenomena in galaxies which could sometimes manifest themselves in the form of radio emission, sometimes in the form of high velocity gas, sometimes in the form of high excitation. All those things, really, you could put together. I mean, that paper, I wrote most of the text, and Margaret and Alan provided a lot of the figures, and we put it all together. It was a very powerful piece of argumentation using circumstantial evidence. People swallowed it, they believe it. There's a tend of a reaction against explosive phenomena now from perverse people like Phil Solomon, Phil Morrison, but that's that has its, I don't know why that is. But radio astronomy clearly first put us onto that track, if it's the right track. I mean, they put us onto that track, if it's the wrong track, it's the wrong track. And of course, the other thing that the radio astronomy did was help us find quasi-stellars.
Right.
But I think it's those aspects which, above all, to me, were the most striking in terms of the overall direction of galactic, extragalactic astronomy. As far as galactic astronomy is concerned, radio sources have not been that important, except as far as the supernova arguments are concerned, where you have to take on faith that radio sources do arise from supernovae. Can you interrupt?
Well, now you mentioned bringing to the fore the violent activity in galaxies. Of course, the Seyferts had been around since the early 40s.
Yeah, but no one had paid much attention to that.
It was just a minor...
We wrote the first paper looking into the Seyferts again in 1959 on NGC 1068, and it was certainly... they just simply been ignored. I mean, after what you have to realize is that 20 years ago, there wasn't much interest in extragalactic astronomy. The interest was largely in stellar evolution and nuclear synthesis, which I suppose we had a lot to do with.
There wasn't much planning.
And color matrix diagrams for clusters and so on. And when we first started going into extragalactic studies in 1957, when we first went to Yerkes on the faculty in Chicago, not very much was going on. And I think a lot of the interest in extragalactic astronomy came through radio astronomy and through a very small number of us who were interested enough and got people excited about it.
Mm-hmm. What about general ideas about the interstellar medium? Do you think that they were changed in any fundamental way?
I've never really written one or two papers on the interstellar medium. I suppose in the galaxy they have, but I can't say that I've had a lot to do with that. I mean, there's been this continuous...
I'm asking you as an observer of the scene.
Hard for me to say. I think that, of course, the arguments about the interstellar magnetic field have always been heavily intertwined with the radio arguments and the arguments based on cosmic ray physics. The models for the interstellar medium, the hot gas and the cold gas, and is there any other... I mean, which components really exist... I don't think you've been grossly affected by radio astronomy.
Right. One final question is, you've made a couple allusions to it, but more explicitly, the general acceptance of radio astronomy into optical astronomy, I'm sort of interested in, as someone who was sort of on the borderline between the two.
On the borderline, right, yeah.
Can you name an error when you think that to be a radio astronomer was not just to be an engineer who knew how to build antennas, but you were accepted at astronomical conferences as one who knew what he was talking about?
Mean, when did that transition?
Yeah, I mean, is that a valid question at all?
I don't know. I think that, first of all, I think that some radio astronomers, Ryle is an extreme example, never wanted to accept that optical astronomy could provide hardly anything. But I used to have this running argument with Ryle about this. He felt that, I mean, he just used to get very antagonistic about optical astronomy. He felt that it could all be done by radio methods. And I used to challenge him and I've used this in questions to students in the following way. I said, all right, Martin, let us suppose that the Earth is continuously covered by a thick blanket of cloud, and always has been. What do you think we could learn about the universe using the radio techniques, all the radio techniques at your disposal? The fact is that I think you can learn very little. First of all, you can't learn the scale of anything. You would see something rising and setting. You might by now even make radar measurements and find there were bodies out there called the planets as we now know them. I don't think you would know anything about the scale or the size or the shape of the universe, really. You certainly wouldn't know anything about scale. The problem with radio astronomy is still remains, as it does in other fields of astronomy, apart from astronomy, is that there's no way of measuring distance. So I think the radio astronomer has got to have the optical astronomer. The most successful radio astronomers are the radio astronomers who have learned something about astronomy. And the least successful have been those who have largely remained electrical engineers. And the Cambridge people learned a tremendous amount of astronomy. Martin was kind of an exception in this kind of an argument. And of course really doesn't use the argument himself, because all of his cosmological arguments are based at some level on on optical observations, right, shaky though they may be.
But he made this exactly same comment at the 76 meeting.
Well, he doesn't change. I mean, he's found...
I found that incredible.
Well, as Fred Hoyle has once put it in a rather brutal way, because Fred has suffered royal, and he's got to the point where he doesn't suffer him very well. I mean, Fred says, well, he's always been rewarded for putting his hand in the till. And... Now, Martin, of course, you were probably present when he engaged him, because I got up and, you remember how he took off against me? Well, that is a measure of the way that, I mean, that reminded me of the way it was 20 years before. And it reminded a lot of other people. John Bolton said, well, that shows the younger people just how it really has been. And it was that way.
And that was the only thing like that in the whole conference. Well, I think it was the only time he made a remark in the whole conference.
Well, I touched a nerve again. And I was touching. I've been doing that for years. No, that's really the case. Now, I mean, Martin is an extreme example. I mean, Martin is a genius. Let's face it. But he's not. I mean, he's more than the most of us. I think that it's a very dubious game that he's played. But he's a genius as far as an engineer, as a designer, in many ways. I mean, I don't begrudge Martin the Nobel Prize at all. But I think that that attitude is one that is extreme.
Well, let's look now at radio astronomy more as a whole. Would you say that there was a transformation at some stage, or is that difficult for you to say?
No, I think it's slow. I mean, obviously it came in the 60s. I mean, there was a time when John Bolton didn't want papers published in the APJ. And for some reason, he believed in the ASP, not the APJ. It's unclear to me. I think that there's still different breeds in many ways, because I think there's still many radio astronomers who are sure there's a better way to do optical astronomy. But of course, I am quite convinced, and everything I've learned about astronomy still leads me to believe that scientists, astronomers, are extremely technique-dominating. I can name very few first-class astronomers who can manage to move effectively from one part of the electromagnetic spectrum to another. Name me an optical astronomer who's become a radio astronomer or an X-ray astronomer, name me an X-ray astronomer, and so on. And this has something to do, observationally at least, with techniques. But I think by the late 1960s, there was less of this kind of separation. But there's a body of knowledge that you have to learn in order to do astronomy, which covers a very wide range of physics. And I mean, I've never taken any astronomy courses, and there are very many physicists in astronomy who have not. But you've simply got to, well, first of all, you've got to admit that there is a very good likelihood that other people have done things. I mean, I remember the Cambridge people in the early days discovering parallaxes, you know, discovering Smart's book, actually.
Precession.
And I remember, you know, telling you where to point and being miles off, and then I remember always in the early days, when we were in London, in the early days of W-identified radio sources, they gave Margaret some positions at the University of London Observatory, and then later on they came and gave her some different ones, which were way off, and, well, they just discovered the position being a sidereal, you know, they just... were learning it all, and they were trying to learn it all from first principles, rather than really accept that there was a literature in the field, and most things, of course, this kind had been long ago worked out.
But what about on the other side, looking at the optical astronomers who the whole technology was beyond their ken? They were working with DC amplifiers and at most at their telescopes.
Well, but I mean, the optical astronomer still, I mean, I'm not sure what you're driving at, because the optical astronomers still, many of them still are not very interested in high energy phenomena in astronomy, which is where radio astronomy is at. They're still quite surprised. I mean, after all, normal stars go through their lives, and normal galaxies go through their lives, it is thought, under the influence of gravity, moving, acting rather slowly, and nuclear forces, and radio emission is just a kind of little blip in the system. It may not be at the beginning, it may not be at the end, it may not be sometimes when certain things are exploding, but there is a whole breed of optical astronomers who still don't think that it's a major it's a major part of astronomy. I mean, and it can lead you to discover new phenomena, but it doesn't necessarily. Most of the photons in the universe apparently have energies around the electron volt. Most of the energy in the universe, I should say, is carried by photons.
Yes, right.
Energy
right.
Range. The microwave background overwhelms everything. That's radio emission.
Right.
If that comes from where people said it was, then there was a time when it dominated. But if you want, I mean, the radio astronomer's time has passed, if you're building music.
That's an interesting point. But now you say most optical astronomers sort of ignore the radio as being a minor part of astronomy, and that may well be true, but do you think that's true as far as the important thrust of astronomy as a whole? In other words, the best optical astronomer?
You see,
as you see,
I have a somewhat, people say that I'm iconic, I'm an iconoclast, I don't think I am, but what I would say is the following. I said it last week when I made a speech at the dedication of the MMT, when I was asked to speak about the next 25 years in astronomical research. Don Osterbrock talked about this too. Don talked about it in terms of the new telescopes, and I thought, well, there's no point in doing the same thing. The part about astronomy, I think, that really is most disturbing to me, astronomy as a whole, is that it's still not a hard science, as physics is, or chemistry, or even biology is getting. And the reason for this is that there are so many phenomena in the universe that we can go and look at in a very schematic way. And we can find out, or we can discover something remarkable that we frankly have never predicted. And we build a picture of the universe based on these fragmentary ideas. And we build ourselves a large inverted pyramid. We don't really test the foundations, we don't really study enough of the detail in enough objects to be quite sure what we're doing. Probably the most certain parts of astronomy are still associated with stellar structure and stellar evolution up to the red giant stage, and I hope nuclear synthesis. And I'm leaving out the solar system where you have more things you can pin down. But my theme was, and I thought the next 25 years should be devoted to really looking very hard at this whole structure and attempting to see if we can make some parts of it reasonably sound rather than just asserting that it is so.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a series of statements which most people believe in, but which I think there's very little foundation for. The following, for example, I said, everybody assumes that galaxies are old. What is the evidence? Everybody believes that the Virial theorem holds. What is the evidence? Everybody believes that most faint radio sources are very far away. What is the evidence? In my view, the evidence is marginal or non-existent in nearly all those cases. And my view was and is that we should spend far more time working to establish the reality or non-reality of some of these beliefs than in pushing on into these exciting areas where you're straining every nerve to get a redshift of one for some reason which is rather...
Apparently then you don't believe it's built into astronomy, the fact that we can only observe from one direction and can never go out there.
It's built in. It's built in. What I'm trying to say is that we could do far better.
We could do better, so, yeah.
For example, I mean, if you want a mindless program, which would probably help us a lot, I would say a field I know, extragalactic astronomy, everything that we base our ideas on is probably based on having looked once maybe twice in a few cases, at a few thousand extragalactic objects. Mm-hmm. Let's start off by getting a million redshifts. See whether we still believe in isotropy, whether we still believe in the Hubble law. What do we believe in?
Well, there are people that are getting a few thousand now anyway.
Is a few thousand. No, you can
it's a hell of a lot better.
Plot the number as a function of time, and it hasn't gone up that much. And there are these terribly difficult problems associated with observers' beliefs. For example, if an observer is trying to find distant galaxies, and he finds a 19th magnitude object on the plate, he assumes before he observes it that it will have a redshift of about 2/10. And I have often challenged some of the people working in this field, because I know how difficult the observations are and what the spectra really look like. Just exchange information. If Jim Gunn gave his tapes to Margaret,
yeah,
and if Margaret gave hers to Spin Man and so on, would they actually get the same answers?
Yeah.
And everybody says, when I say this among experts, yes, well, that's a very good question, but no one would dare do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is the whole thing is based on not very much.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of belief. It's read almost, you know, I mean, we've worked so hard, we've tried so long, we must be right, we can't be wrong.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Jeff Burbage on 22 May 1979 at Kitt Peak.